are listening to Banal of America Audio.
Beyond just sort of like fixing a game, it's like the league sort of fixes the storylines of the season or the storyline of the sport in general. So it seems like there's teams that are sort of favored nations, and then there's teams that just get completely, they don't get any coverage or sort of any of the buzz, if you will. And it definitely seems like that's all manufactured.
Well, and I think to a certain extent it is. I mean, I think you had the Red Sox and the whole Boston Strong thing. I mean, I don't believe in coincidence. Especially when you're in a billion-dollar industry like sports. You know, suddenly the Boston Strong thing comes and the Red Sox go from being a last-place team to being World Series champions to back to being a last-place team this year.
you look at
the New Orleans Saints. New Orleans Saints had this 40-year history of ineptitude. Suddenly Hurricane Katrina strikes the city, and all of a sudden the Saints single-handedly apparently rebuilt the city of New Orleans, and they would come out and win a Super Bowl, you know, 2 or 3 years later. I mean, I don't believe these are necessarily just happy coincidences, like the Patriots winning after 9/11. I don't think those things just happened to the benefit of the league by accident. I don't buy it.
Yeah.
So I think, and especially, again, when we go back to what we talked about earlier, how the league does have the ability to control these things, you know, if they do so, again, isn't it the best business decision? Because who didn't love the Saints and the whole Hurricane Katrina story? You know, I mean, everybody in America seemed to love that story and roll with it, despite the fact that it was just nonsense. It was still a feel-good story, and people bought into it.
Right, right. And I've really been on the Royals bandwagon this month, but you can kind of see it in that whole thing, too, where it's like they're this plucky underdog, 30 years not in the playoffs, and all of a sudden they're on this crazy run. It's like it makes you sort of do a double take where you're like, anytime they're like, it couldn't have been written any better, you really should stop for a moment and be like, but was it?
Yeah, and I bring that up a lot of times in the Fixes In, how many times guys have said exactly that. You know, you couldn't have scripted it any better. Well, then maybe was it scripted? I mean, wasn't it? I mean, like you say, with the Royals. I know a lot of people who, you know, they're baseball fans, and they said, well, I'm going to root for the Royals because they're the underdog. Well, why do you care if the Royals win? You know, if you're a Cub fan or you're a fan of whatever baseball team, if you're not a Royals fan, why do you care who wins the World Series? Because that's not your team. But yet they're able to make you care about one team or the other just because you're a baseball fan and just because you still want to watch that game and you still want to get some sort of joy from watching it. They create these storylines and you buy right into them as a fan. And they
know
this.
And not to get too like metaphysical in a sense, but they're also – they may not there also may be something sort of metaphysical at work here in a sense where if they get enough people sort of – rooting for the Royals, maybe there's something in the ether. You know, we are a paranormal program, but, you know, maybe there's something in the ether that just sort of gets it that last little push that just sort of, like, pushes the ball the right way in a really metaphysical sense. I mean, maybe they may not even know they're doing it, you know, the sports leagues, but maybe if it's like, if they reach a certain point where enough people are behind sort of an idea, it takes on a life of its own. Maybe that's what's going on in a lot of ways, too.
It's, I would not write that off. I think, again, like you say, it's always a possibility.
Yeah.
I mean, they've done enough scientific things to say, you know, people can influence a random number generator by thinking about it hard enough. You know, who's to say that's not possible? But I think, again, I think it's more the leagues are just preying on these fans who want to keep wanting. and that they use whatever means they can to feed that habit, to feed that addiction.
Yeah, yeah. Let me see, I lost my train of thought here. I had a question I was going to ask you, so let me throw into one of my notes here. We'll talk about, this is like the most famous, one of the most famous conspiracy theories like ever with sports, and that's the 85 NBA draft lottery. Now, I watched the video, like maybe, I don't know, an hour before we sat down to talk, so like a couple hours ago, I was watching the video. It is pretty interesting, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, I'm still on the fence about it. But I guess talk to people about this 85 draft conspiracy theory, because that seems to be one of the biggest sports conspiracies like ever in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, the thing that drives me nuts in a way, before I even talk about that, is just that term conspiracy theory. Because I wrote The Fixes In, and it is I guess in the general sense, a conspiracy theory, because I talk about leagues fixing their own games for television ratings and what have you, is, you know, I got labeled as the sports conspiracy theorist, and apparently I'm the only one out there, so I'm the biggest one, you know, in the nation, in the world, whatever you want to call it. But the thing is it bothers me because I'm not really a conspiracy theorist. What I am is I'm a skeptic, and I hate the way the word skeptic got hijacked.
Right.
Because, you know, there's the Skeptical Inquirer and there's Skeptic Magazine, but those people are really only skeptical of people like me. They're not skeptical of the mainstream idea. They're skeptical of people like me who question the mainstream idea, which to me makes me the skeptic, not them.
Right.
I'm the skeptic. So when you look at something like this NBA draft in 1985, you know, you had this Patrick Ewing, who was, you know, like a guaranteed can't-miss prospect, although occasionally those guys still miss. But he was this, you know, sure thing. And you had, what was it, seven teams, I think, vying to be the top pick in the lottery to get Patrick Ewing. And six of the teams were far-flung places, you know, Seattle, Sacramento, places most NBA fans didn't care about. But one was New York, the New York Knicks. And it just so happened that the New York Knicks wound up getting the first pick and, of course, acquiring Patrick Ewing, and he went on to a Hall of Fame career with the New York Knicks. But the actual lottery itself, many people, including myself, think it was rigged. And wouldn't it be a smart move to rig it? Because why have a can't-miss prospect like Patrick Ewing play in Sacramento where no one's going to see him? It's much better for the league to have the entire league, you know, not Sacramento included. It's better for Patrick Ewing to be in New York City because it's the country's number one media market. They're constantly on national television. It draws interest to the league, and that actually in turn benefits places like Sacramento and Seattle because of the revenue sharing and what have you within these networks. But the actual event, I mean, you kind of have to see it to understand it, but the there's seven cards, one for each team, and envelopes that are put into a hopper. The hopper is spun, and then the commissioner draws out, which is the number one pick. Well, when they're dealing them into the hopper, whoever the guy is who's dealing them, the fourth card, which would be the middle card, whether you started from the top or the bottom, the middle card is the fourth card, gets, for some reason, violently slammed against the side of the hopper.
Hmm.
Now, it makes no sense to deal the cards into the hopper when it's going to be spun and mixed up anyway, but he does this, and he dog-ears that corner when he does it. And so they spin this hopper, which is clear, a big clear basketball. They stop, but the commissioner goes to reach in. He grabs like two or three envelopes, tosses two aside, keeps the dog-eared one, and lo and behold, the dog-eared one is the one with the New York Knicks logo, and they win the number one draft pick, and they get Patrick Ewing, and everything works out for everybody involved. And so, you know, I've heard rumors that the envelope was frozen and, you know, it was done through sleight of hand or whatever, but I think it's really obvious when you watch it enough times what exactly happened. And then when you think about it, why it happened, it makes perfect sense because, again, it's the best business decision for the league to make at that time.
Hmm. And even, yeah, because like when I was watching it, I was trying to figure out if it was really damaged enough for them to for David Stern to really pick up on it. But then now thinking more about it, it's like it's kind of like the shell game in a way. As long as the guy sort of who throws it into the barrel makes it obvious which one he's supposed to watch when they roll the thing, he probably could have kept his eye on it enough to be able to do it. You know?
Especially when there's only seven.
Right.
You know, it's not like there's 100 ping pong balls and you had to draw one out. I mean, there's seven cards.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, like you say, it makes it pretty easy to follow that one, you know.
Yeah, as long as you know which one it is that you're supposed to be watching, then he should have been able to easily pick up on it. So it's I remember now. My lost train of thought just pulled into the station, which is always a good sign. So I don't know if you had to have seen this story that happened over the summer. I thought this was remarkable. It's another thing that kind of made me think about your work, and this was during the All-Star game. Do you remember the pitcher? Derek Jeter got the hit, and then they asked him during the game, you know, between the innings or whatever, he was in the dugout, and he's like, yeah, I kind of served it up to him. And then and it became a huge thing, and it was like, that to me was kind of a glimpse in a way into what may really be going on and how badly they don't want anyone to talk about it, because I think he had to offer a retraction to the whole thing before the game was over. It was like, he gave up the hit in the first inning. In the fifth inning, he said he served it up to him. And by the ninth, he was like, I was just joking, folks. Please don't hate me or run me out of baseball. So it was a crazy microcosm of what may really be going on.
Well, and that's funny because you saw it at the end of the season with Derek Jeter. I mean, for some reason, I still don't even understand why, but this being Derek Jeter's last season, it was a circus. Every appearance he made at every stadium was like, oh, don't miss, Derek Jeter. Well, he's a good baseball player. He's not Babe Ruth, but he's pretty good. So I understand it. But at the very last game of the season, the last game he played in Yankee Stadium, there's a lot of theory about the last hit he got was a game-winning RBI that won the game for the team. A lot of people thought that was really highly suspicious and a served-up pitch as well.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we've seen that before. I mean, Cal Ripken hit a couple of famous home runs, and I was a huge Cal Ripken fan as a kid. That seemed highly suspicious, one in his last All-Star game and one in the game where he broke Lou Gehrig's all-time record for a number of games played. Both of those pitches seem to be really fat, easy, served-up pitches. Now, granted, he still has to hit it out of the park, but as a professional hitter, it's got to be a lot easier if you got a fat pitch than if you got a hard pitch to hit.
Hmm.
And so, I mean, yeah, exactly. The funny thing was the reaction. I mean, here, the All-Star game really doesn't mean anything. They made it kind of mean home field advantage in the World Series, but for the most part, it really doesn't mean anything. It was kind of an exhibition game, and people, like you said, went crazy because there was a thought that, oh, my God, this might not be real. Well, duh. It might not be real. Well, why are you getting so bent out of shape out of it? I mean, it's like, you get flipped out because of the high score in the NHL All-Star game or the NBA All-Star game. I mean, that are exhibitions. And I think all these games really are exhibitions. It's just you seem to want to place more meaning on other games than you do these games. But it's what it is.
Yeah. It's very strange. Now, the other one, the other fixed game that I'd never heard this story before or the theory was the Super Bowl III conspiracy theory. And let me stop because you were talking about conspiracies, and it's like the idea of conspiracy and everything. I totally agree with you, especially about the skeptic part. You actually summed up the problem with skeptics better than anybody I've heard on this show in a long, long time. That is the problem. They're skeptical of anyone who thinks against the grain, which is sad. But conspiracies, it's like sports is a grand conspiracy in a way. I mean, people get confused. They think that like Roger Goodell like owns the NFL or some crap, or David Stern owned the NBA or something. It's a small coterie of vastly wealthy people who own these little enterprises throughout the country and then work together to generate profit. I mean, what more of a conspiracy do you need, folks? That is a legitimate conspiracy. They're colluding to make money, whether the games are fixed or not. That's their whole goal here, is to work together to make money. So you talk about conspiracies. That's it right there.
Well, I was going to say one thing that really I think proves my point, which many people tend to write off, was there actually was a known, proven conspiracy in Major League Baseball, which was collusion, which took place in the mid-1980s, where all the owners, every team owner, literally got together with the room with the commissioner and basically agreed, we're not going to pay for anybody else's free agents when they come on the market. And this happened for 3 years in a row. I mean, if they hadn't made it so blatantly obvious what they were doing, they would have likely gotten away with it. But the fact of the matter was, every owner agreed to this idea, and it didn't matter if it cost you wins or losses. It was all about the money. It was they all wanted to save money. They all wanted to keep player salaries down, so they all colluded, a conspiracy, the true definition of a conspiracy, they colluded to ensure this happened, and it did. It wound up costing them $280 million in legal fees down the line, but the fact of the matter was, the owners all agreed to do this, and you're right. The owners are the ones who run these leagues. Roger Goodell, the way our government should be, like Obama, he should just be kind of a figurehead. He shouldn't be the guy in charge, and that's the same with the NFL. Roger Goodell really isn't in charge. It's the 32 owners that are in charge of this league, and they are what make things happen, and they're what they say really what's what. They just allow Roger Goodell to kind of be the, figurehead for this whole enterprise. Hmm. But the fact is those 32 guys are running the show, and they'll do what they need to do to be profitable. And I think that's why people get hung up on the fact that, well, why would they rig, a Super Bowl to let, this team win and not that team? Well, why not? When is it going to be our turn? When is it going to be that team's turn? Well, the fact is, every year one team has to win. It's going to happen regardless if it's fixed or not. One team has to win. the question is, how does it benefit the league? When you have a league like the NFL where 80% of all revenue made is shared, well, then you could see, okay, maybe the New Orleans Saints storyline after Katrina is a great moneymaker. So when the Lions, I think they were like 1-15 that year, they were going to basically make as much money as the Saints did, and the Saints won the Super Bowl just because of the way the league is constructed. So maybe the Lions owner would be like, hey, the Saints win, that's cool, because that's going to be more money in my coffers because more people are interested in the Saints. I mean,
yeah,
that's the way these things work.
Mm-hmm. Now, so to circle back to what started me on that tangent, Super Bowl III and also Super Bowl, but mostly Super Bowl III, and how there seemed like it all seemed to work a little too conveniently for the league. That might be the best way of putting it, but I'll set you up there and sort of recount the details on this.
Well, I wasn't the first one to point this out about Super Bowl III. I mean, there's a former player, a guy by the name of Bernie Parrish, and that's kind of one of the things that kind of got me started down this road, is he wrote a book called, they call it A Game. And Bernie, he was a former member of the Cleveland Browns, and then he actually worked in the Players Association, the union for a long time. But he wrote this book in the early 1970s, and he basically said Super Bowl III was too good to be true. He said it literally made the NFL what it is, and he's right. Back at that era, in the early couple Super Bowls, the AFL and the NFL were two separate leagues that had merged. And what people forget is that the AFL was kind of a laughingstock. They were kind of almost like, you know, the XFL tried to be when Vince McMahon started his own football league.
Yeah.
They were a different kind of league, and NFL fans did not really accept the AFL, despite the fact that nowadays professional football is a lot more like the AFL than the old NFL. At the time, there was probably, they figured the fans were about 3-1, 3 in favor of the NFL, 1 for the AFL. And what happened was, is when they had those first two Super Bowls and the NFL team, the Packers, demolished the AFL team, all the owners in both leagues panicked, because they were here, they were merging these two leagues together. There was millions of dollars, what would become billions of dollars, on the line down the road, and they were afraid fans were not going to accept what they were doing. So here comes Super Bowl III, and you have Joe Namath and the New York Jets facing basically, literally, without exaggerating, one of the greatest teams the NFL has ever fielded in the Baltimore Colts that season. And lo and behold, Namath predicts that the Jets are going to win. He guarantees it. And sure enough, the Jets go out there and win the game. And everybody calls it, you know, one of the greatest, you know, upsets of all times. But the fact of the matter is, that was a huge business win for the NFL. And it really solidified the merger. It really created the modern-day NFL. And it meant millions upon millions of dollars to every one of those owners, even the Colts owner who lost that game.
Yeah. And it set the stage. It really sort of birthed the Super Bowl, like you say in the book, that, you know, there was serious doubt about whether they would even have a Super Bowl anymore, or you know, it was like, would you really need this game, or what? So it's amazing when you see how huge the Super Bowl is now, how it was on the fringe there for a while.
Well, exactly, and like I say, I mean, it created the modern NFL in a very real way, and it gets lost, I think, over the course of history. You know, fans don't really necessarily know the history, or even fans forget the reality of that situation. Like you said, there was a time where the Super Bowl was really going to be eliminated. They didn't see the need for it. I mean, you know, you think about it today where it's like a national holiday, the Super Bowl. There's a point in time early on when the game was kind of an afterthought, and the game was almost going to be canceled and eliminated. I mean, that's how big that moment in time was. And like I said, it was a huge business win for the NFL and the AFL owners, and it made them multimillionaires just because of that one outcome. And when you look at the game and what the Colts did, and how one of the greatest teams in NFL history completely fell apart in that game, it made me wonder, and it's made other people wonder, well, did they really fall apart, or did they intentionally come apart at the seams because of what it meant to everyone else involved?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, if we're sort of running with the idea of these sort of like behind-the-scenes machinations of all this, it's sort of interesting because I remember growing up, I grew up like in the 80s and obviously up till today. So, but I grew up in the 80s and in the 90s, and the Super Bowl was always like terrible until like the last decade or maybe 15 years. Then it started becoming really good. You notice that? It was like it used to be really bad, like the game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up with the same – I'm just a few years older than you are.
Mm.
And I the same thing. Yeah, I mean, the Super Bowl to me as a kid was – you didn't really care. You almost kind of knew what was going to happen before it happened type of game. And now, yeah, one of the things the NFL, I think, loves to prey upon is this idea they have of parity. And this is something that the commissioner back in the day, Pete Rozelle, designed. And he basically wanted the idea where any team could beat any other team any week. And that even if your team came in last place last year, this year they could win the Super Bowl. I mean, that was the creation of parity. That's what they wanted, was everybody was kind of equal. And in reality, what the NFL would really like is, I think, every team to be 8-8. Where the last week of the season, everything was on the line, so every game mattered, and nobody would know who would win or what would happen. And I think it's a perfect vehicle to hide behind, if we're talking about the kind of manipulation I believe goes on. Because if you ingrain that in fans' heads, that there's this parity that any team could beat any team, well, then no result raises any question. Because you have that thought in the head, well, the best team in the league can lose to the worst team in the league thanks to parity. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
It goes, hooray. That's what we want. Well, if you're going to manipulate games, that's great. Because then you can create things. You can create things like the whole Tim Tebow phenomenon, and people will believe it. Because, hooray, parity. That's what we want. And that's what we get. But at the same time, it's a great, great way to manipulate people and manipulate games.
Hmm. Because otherwise, I guess the parody is kind of like evolution in a way, where you have to either believe in it or not, in a sense. Because it seems like parody, how has it even come about? How did it even come out in the last few years? It's sort of a nebulous idea in a way, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could see, like, with the draft, the idea that, you know, draft, the worst team gets the first pick and things of that nature.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the fact is, I mean, these are all professional athletes. They all are much more athletic than most of the people in the country. I mean, that's, you know, in all these leagues. You know, there's only so many guys who do these things.
Hmm.
No, I don't think there's many guys who could be LeBron James if they tried to be LeBron James, because he is just that gifted. He's that much of an athlete over and above everybody else. I mean, same with some of these NFL quarterbacks. I mean, you could see some of these guys, you know, it seems like they could throw the ball for 300 yards in the air if they wanted to. Whereas, you know, other guys have a hard time throwing it 20 yards. I mean, it's just some guys are that gifted.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things, again, the leagues realize and prey upon is the fact that some of these guys are true superstars, and they'll promote them and, you know, manipulate things for them to keep them being superstars because people latch on to them. And I think that's one of the things they prey on. But with parity, it's, you know, not every team can get lucky enough to find a guy like that, even with the draft. But again, it's enough where with the league, the revenue sharing and the drafts and the other things that make the playing fields pretty even, it allows for parity to exist. And again, I think it's something they prey upon.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier the XFL. As I said, I'm a big wrestling fan, so I always kind of found it interesting just how it had all that backing of NBC, but it definitely seemed like it was kind of like murdered by the sports media. Because I remember here in Boston, well, there wasn't any team in Boston, but still, like, they would only put like the box score in on like the eighth page of the sports section. You know, it was completely marginalized in the sense where it was like they completely shut out the XFL from ever trying to be anything. I mean, I know, and I think that the historically low ratings were the end result of all that. You know, like they made it uncool to like that. Or, like, unsavory for real sports fans to like it. So then it became a self-fulfilling prophecy where nobody, you know, got behind it and turned on the XFL.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it's funny because, really, the XFL in many ways parodied what happened with the AFL in the 1960s. Because the AFL was the upstart league back then. I mean, they were started by 8 millionaires who wanted to buy into the NFL and weren't allowed to, so they decided they'd go start their own league, and they did. And that league was really on the verge of failure until, oddly enough, NBC invested into the AFL, and then all of a sudden it created a rival equal to that of the NFL. And at the time, I mean, you got to remember sports media in the 1960s is way different than it was when the XFL came about. And I think you're exactly right. I think they had the backing of a major network, but at the same time, they didn't have the same influence over the professional sports media that the AFL was allowed to have.
Hmm.
And because of that, like you said, it almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy. People said, oh, this isn't, you know, real football. This is nonsense. It's run by this guy who runs professional wrestling. And, you know, they did everything they could to mock the product, and because of that, it, I think, helped destroy it. Whereas, you know, you look at the USFL, which came about in, was in the mid-1980s, and that had a real chance of success. It really did, because, again, it didn't get as mocked and as obliterated as the XFL did by the media.
Yeah, didn't Donald Trump just kill the XFL, that's all?
He was part of it. I mean, his money would have definitely helped the league, but he wasn't directly responsible for the killing of it. But, I mean, it was successful, and it had a chance to be more successful. I mean, it you know, some great stars came out of there. I mean, Reggie White, Steve Young, a couple other XFL guys became Hall of Famers in the NFL.
Hmm.
And they had that kind of talent.
Here's another thing. This is one that should resonate with people, too. Talk about conspiracies and just the way the media is manipulated and the sway of the sports groups. I thought it was really interesting, the section in The Fix Is In about new stadiums and how much chicanery is involved in this, and just how it really is ridiculous. I think that people are finally starting to kind of turn on the idea of new stadiums, but it was really quite kind of an epidemic in a way, where they built a lot of these in the last like 20 years or so. So I guess talk about sort of the fallacies of new stadiums and how they sell these as like this great thing for a city, but then it turns out the city pays most of the money and never really benefits at all.
Well, yeah, you got that exactly right. I mean, they've had these guys, economists who have studied stadiums and teams that have professional sports teams and how much those teams and the stadiums actually bring to the city in terms of revenue. And they found that really a new stadium or a sports team being in a certain city really has no added benefit whatsoever to that city, economically speaking, at least. I mean, they found that, like, when the Baltimore Colts left Baltimore and moved to Indianapolis, you know, while many Indianapolis or Baltimore Colts fans were up in arms and distraught and, you know, everything, it really didn't destroy the city of Baltimore. What they found is that the people who spent the money on Baltimore Colts games went and spent their money on other entertainment, you know, outlets. They went to plays or concerts or, you know, what have you. They spent that entertainment money elsewhere, and that's what it is. They found that even though a city may build a stadium and, you know, a couple of restaurants or attractions around it, it doesn't necessarily revitalize a stadium. It costs way too much for building the stadium in terms of job creation, because it doesn't really create full-time jobs except during the construction period. After that, every job that stadium creates is a part-time gig. It's not as beneficial as many people make it out to be, and in many times, really, the teams are robbing these cities blind. And what I equate a lot of it to is basically sports in general, really, the whole idea of the gladiator games back in ancient Rome, where the government put on the gladiator contests basically to distract the people in order to, you know, allow the government to get away with literally murder in certain cases in ancient Rome. And I think you can really equate that to today, because a lot of these stadiums, most of these stadiums are funded by public money. They're funded by the government. And the sports do exactly the same thing today. They distract people from the greater things that are going on in this country. And I think, you know, you can draw a real parallel between the two, because, you know, the NFL is a nonprofit organization, believe it or not. You know,
oh,
the teams are not, but the headquarters, the NFL itself, is a nonprofit organization. I mean, the bowl games in the college sports, you know, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl, those are actually supposedly charitable organizations that pay no taxes.
That's
okay.
Crazy.
And so, exactly, it's insane. But, again, the government has kind of an influence in sports, and sports kind of an influence on government. And I think those kind of connections exist, if you want to get, again, conspiratorial, exactly because of the way the gladiator games worked back in ancient Rome, is they distracted the people.
Yeah.
And that's what sports does today. And that's one of the things, that's one of the offenses I take at sports, is how serious people take sports over and above a lot of other things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Sports matter too much.
Mm, yeah, got to have a balance in your life. I tell this to the paranormal listeners all the time, too. You can't just be all about UFOs. So the listeners here, it can't just all be about sports. It's got to be, you got to have a mix of everything. Now, someone in the chat room mentioned this, and it hit sort of a nerve with me, because it's been something I've been interested in a while. I guess talk a little bit about, because I don't know if you've really written much about it, but the NCAA, that seems like such a corrupt organization. There seems to be so much chicanery involved with that. seems like maybe people are starting to kind of wake up to it. But then on the other end of the spectrum, it's like they got this college football playoff now. They're only going to get more powerful and more devious as time. They're going to morph more into these professional leagues and become very, very suspect. So I guess talk a little bit about sort of the rise of the NCAA and just this nefarious organization.
Well, it's funny that so many people get bent out of shape about, like, recruiting violations because, you know, a lot of players get paid under the table by boosters and by programs to come to that college. You know, that's a practice that's literally 100 years old, if not older. I mean, it really started back in the days of Yale and Harvard when they had football teams. They would pay ringers to come play on their team. It's not a new creation. It's been around forever. But the fact is it's just gotten so out of control. And, I mean, you could talk about corruption in the NCAA and college sports, you know, for hours on end. It's an insane institute. I mean, my personal thought is you cannot fix it. You can't. You can't fix, especially when we're talking about college sports, we're talking about football and basketball, which
right.
are two big moneymakers. I mean, in my opinion, they are professional leagues. If nothing else, they're the minor leagues of the professional sports. And this whole idea of, you know, players have tried to unionize. There's talk about paying the players, which I can't comprehend because, and I forget what it is, it's like 45 of the 50 states in America, the highest paid state employee is either a college or football coach or a college basketball coach.
Yeah.
Which alone is frightening. So how are you going to justify, okay, I live in Wisconsin, our highest paid public employee isn't our governor, isn't some senator, it's the college football coach for the Badgers. Now, how am I supposed to feel about, well, the team needs a new left tackle, so let's take some of my tax money to go find a left tackle for the team. Well, wait a second. I don't like the fact that I'm paying this college coach's salary. Now I got to pay for his, you know, a player. I mean, it's insane. I don't understand how you can do that. My opinion is you have to blow the whole system up. You have to just eliminate it.
Yeah.
Because it's so corrupt on so many levels. You cannot fix it. You cannot fix it and make it what it's supposed to be, an amateur thing done by student athletes who are students first and then athletes. Now, they're athletes and they're not students. It's a completely different idea.
Who do you think, like, pulls the strings behind all that? Because that seems like it would be even more difficult to manipulate in a way, just because there's so many colleges and so many sort of interested parties and stuff. It's not necessarily as easy to sort of hold sway over as like 32 owners or something like that.
Well, it is and it isn't, because, I mean, you have, like, in college sports, you have things like the Big Ten, you have the SEC, you have the ACC, you have these conferences. And, I mean, the SEC is like professional football down there,
right,
let's
right.
be honest.
They got, like, their own channel and everything, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So does the Big Ten. They have the Big Ten Network. I mean, these guys, and it's hard to pinpoint who they are, but the chancellors and whatever, these colleges, I mean, there is a huge, I mean, billions of dollars flowing into these places, these organizations, from the likes of ESPN and other, you know, networks to fund these things. But yet you don't see any relief for the colleges. You know, it's not like the tuition at the SEC colleges is a dollar. You know, it's still incredibly expensive to go to these colleges, but yet they're making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So where is that money going? Who is it going to? It seems like nobody seems to want to know, because there is so much involved in it all. I mean, it's a really, like you say, it's a huge web, a deception, and nobody seems to want to really delve into it and see what's what.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Because, like I said, it seems to be getting worse.
And like you say, I mean, and that's why I think it's ripe for fixing. Because, again, you see so many of these kids, they're not dumb. I mean, you walk into a, you know, Michigan college, you walk onto their football field, there's 100,000 people standing around you, you're being broadcast on ABC on a primetime game, and, you know, people are wearing your jersey in the stands, and you, as the athlete, you know, you're basically getting paid by college tuition, which when you go to that college, they, you know, we don't really care if you go to the class or not. We're
right.
not concerned about that. We want you to play on Saturday and play really well. We'll take care of the classes for you. I mean, you're really not getting an education. But, I mean, I think you're standing there and you're going, well, there's millions of dollars being made here, and I'm not seeing a dime of this. And so, again, if somebody comes up to him and says, hey, look, you know, you're not probably NFL material, but, you know, you're the star of this team. Yeah, how about you make a little money for what the effort you're giving out there, but maybe we just don't want you to give as much effort as perhaps you could.
Right.
And, I mean, I think that's just how simple it can be. And I'm sure it happens. I mean, they've done studies in the NCAA that proves that it happens. I mean, it happens on a massive scale. I mean, they did an anonymous survey of something like 19,000 student-athletes back in 2008-2009, and a little less than 1% of both the college football players and college basketball players had flat-out admitted in this anonymous survey to fixing games, to shaving points, which equated to about 200 games a year. And that's 200 scandals that nobody ever heard about and no one's ever touched.
Yeah.
And about 1.5% of each side, so another like 400, admitted to knowing about a game being fixed or someone else being involved in shaving points. So, I mean, it is probably actually very rampant at our colleges, and just no one's digging into it and no one knows about it.
Now, because I'm a huge conspiracy buff myself, and it's probably heresy to say, but I've always believed that this whole Spygate thing was like the tip of the iceberg, and that it was probably way worse than it ever, you know, that we ever found out. Because it seemed like there was quite the cover up involved with all that. And it's, if you look at it from a jaundiced eye, it's like the NFL could never say that a Super Bowl was swayed by cheating. It would just completely, like, ruin the league. It would just be a huge, 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 huge problem for them. So it makes sense that they would cover it up. But and because I'm from the New England area, I've actually probably, like, not looked into it enough because I don't want to know. But but I've got to do the due diligence here. What do you think about the whole Spygate thing? Because it's like such a nerve. No one around here, if someone brings it up, we get very defensive. We're like, oh, you know, go to hell, that kind of thing. So, but to me, just the reaction and the way it is, it seems to me it's like, oh, there's probably way more there than meets the eye, and you know, they want people just to forget about it. So I guess, give me your thoughts on Spygate.
Well, I think it was way bigger than the NFL made it out to be. I mean, I think it was the NFL in huge cover-up mode to try to quell that well before it got any traction in the media. And again, that's another story that the sports media really let just slip by, because in many ways, I think, like you said, people in the area, they didn't want to know. They didn't want to know, and if they did know, they didn't want to make it broadcast that there's a potential that, you know, the Super Bowl was basically fixed or they cheated or however you want to put it.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the level. I mean, I've heard basically from people kind of not necessarily involved, but around that whole subject that the Patriots did much worse than really came out in the whole Spygate scandal.
Hmm.
That it was actually a much more complex system that they instituted and got away with for years. And it allowed them to win. I mean, if you look at their home record, just look at their home record, the Patriots' home record since Belichick showed up.
Hmm.
And they're unbeatable at home. Well, come on, home field advantage is not that great in the NFL to make them basically unbeatable at home, unless they're doing something in their home stadium that they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Just leave it at that, okay? Just
exactly.
Contemplate that. You know, people think about that. And, I mean, I think that's the fact of the matter is that you look, you know, Belichick's been considered a genius. Tom Brady's considered a Hall of Fame player, but Belichick was not a genius when he was a coach at the Cleveland Browns before. He was terrible, okay? Suddenly in the Patriots, he's a genius. Well, maybe Spygate had something to do with that. Tom Brady was the seventh-round draft pick. He was not supposed to be that great of a player. The Patriots, in the year they went to the Super Bowl when they really blew up after 9/11, they had Drew Bledsoe as their quarterback, who was a $100 million player. I mean, that was the salary. And yet he gets injured, could come back a couple weeks later, but doesn't, and he gets replaced by this unproven rookie who leads them to the Super Bowl. Well, maybe that's because Tom Brady was willing to cheat using the signals and such that was unveiled by Spygate, and Drew Bledsoe wasn't. And that's what separated him and allowed him to go to Dallas and do what he did and kept Tom Brady and Belichick, you know, side by side and made them into champions because they were cheating for years.
Right, right.
I mean, that's something that a lot of, like you say, Patriot fans won't acknowledge that in the least because then it ruins the fantasy of it all. And I think a lot of NFL fans don't want to think about it either because it ruins the fantasy of it all. But the fact of the matter is we know this occurred. We know it was much greater than the NFL alluded to, So what really happened? We still don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, we try not to talk about it here, but I had to do the due diligence because to me it's always stuck out as something very suspicious, and people
but
always,
I mean,
point out they haven't really won a Super Bowl since all that went down. So it's like, oh shit.
Well, and that's, like I say, that's the funny part is the fans, it's like they don't want to know. They don't want to, you know, find out that, you know, Santa Claus isn't real. But, you know, you'd rather celebrate the make-believe. That's what you want to celebrate. You want to celebrate. You want to cling to that memory. That's how addicted fans are. You want to cling to that memory of winning the Super Bowl and how great it made you feel, despite the fact you're not a member of the team. You want to cling to that so bad you're not willing to look at the reality of it all. And I think that it just shows a lot about American society, not just sports fans.
Now, disease, I suppose it probably goes like both ways, but do these leagues, do they collude with each other, or they like compete with each other? I mean, there are instances. I remember a couple of years ago, the Ravens were supposed to have the home opener, and the Orioles had a game that night, and they kind of pushed the NFL out, and it was kind of like a big to-do at the time. So I guess, on a broader sense, have you heard of instances either, you know, where they're colluding with each other or where they're competing with each other to sort of get the most market share?
You know, not that I'm aware of that they really compete or fight against each other. I mean, I think they're all smart enough business-wise to know that it's better if, you know, I mean, you look at the way schedules are arranged and, you know, nobody really tries to compete with the NFL. Like, even the World Series is pushed back to Tuesday just to make sure it doesn't compete with Monday Night Football.
Right, right.
You know, things like that. I mean, I think they're smart enough to know, we'll give you that space, we'll take this space, you use that, we'll use this, and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I don't think they're necessarily against each other. I don't think they're necessarily with each other. But I think, you know, they're aware of what's going on.
Yeah, like a tenuous peace, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're all working the marks anyway, so they all, as long as they all get sort of their share of the grift, they can kind of get along all right.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's what it boils down to.
Now I'm gonna put you on the spot here, dude, and I apologize, but you wrote this on your blog, and it absolutely it made me go crazy because I was so fascinated. And I'm gonna give you an out right now. You can say I can't talk about this right now. You can say that. That's fine. But you say on your blog, just a personal note for followers of this site. While I cannot go into detail at this point, suffice it to say that I now have proof, firsthand personal proof, that ESPN has zero journalistic integrity. And then you write later, never trust one of their reports again, no matter the supposed subject matter. Now, I know, like I said, I hate to put you on the spot, dude, but that's some powerful stuff. So can you enlighten us at all to that statement?
Well, yeah, I mean, there might be a little hyperbole in there. But the fact of the matter is going back to that Sports Illustrated article I did with Lance Williams, is we did this whole investigation of this allegedly fixed Major League Baseball game. It turned out the game was not fixed, but it really raised questions, like we talked about earlier, of how Major League Baseball security, what they can do, what they did do, and how they got away with it all. And when it wasn't up to Lance and I as to where this article wound up. Mm-hmm. This goes to the Center for Investigative Reporting. With all their articles, they kind of determine the best outlet and where to publish this stuff.
Yeah.
So one of the places they went to first was ESPN, because you know, they're the supposed worldwide leader in sports. ESPN, the first time we went to them, basically like never got back to us, apparently. They just were like, okay, thanks, and whatever. So we went to a couple other outlets. Those other outlets, for whatever reason, turned it down. We went back to ESPN. The guy, the second editor we dealt with, was first he liked the article, then he wanted to publish it, and then we got to the point of, well, is it going to be in ESPN the magazine? Is it going to be online, or is it going to be on both? And then ESPN's lawyers stepped in.
Wow.
And ESPN's lawyers put the kibosh on the whole thing. In fact, they put the kibosh on the fact of ESPN even working with this nonprofit organization known as the Center for Investigative Reporting entirely. Okay. So you have to really question what ES, because, I mean, here's an article that's not, we're not saying the game was fixed. We're saying this is what happened. This is the investigation. Major League Baseball, to a certain extent, actually worked with us on this to get everything correct. And yet ESPN wouldn't run the story. And so you have to, like, to me, it makes me really wonder what ESPN does, what their journalistic integrity is, and how far they'll go for their, editors and writers there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember it was really controversial when all those accusations came out against Ben Roethlisberger in the bar down there, and it was like ESPN waited like 3 days to report on it, and everyone was like really raised a lot of eyebrows about ESPN because it was like, why haven't they even mentioned this whole story? It's a big national news story, but they wouldn't report it for like 3 days. So,
well, and that's what you got to think about. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what ESPN is. I mean, ESPN isn't ESPN; it's actually Disney.
Yeah.
And I mean, you go to the whole. If people are aware of the Frontline story, where two of ESPN's writers, actually one of which who worked with my buddy Lance Williams to write a book about Barry Bonds and Balco called Game of Shadows,
mm-hmm.
They wrote this whole book about League of Denial, about the concussions in the NFL. And then they were working with PBS to produce this Frontline documentary about concussions in the NFL. And then supposedly ESPN put the kibosh on the whole thing, too. And they said, we're not dealing with it. Well, what happened really was Disney. Okay, not ESPN, but Disney had a meeting with the NFL, and together they decided that ESPN gets out.
Huh.
So, I mean, you're talking about some heavy corporate hitters here that are dealing with these things, and it was really them who got the whole thing, got ESPN out of it.
Yeah.
And then our thing followed actually after that a few months later. So, I mean, that's the corporate culture at ESPN, and I mean, it makes me really question some of the writers and such who work for ESPN because there's got to be other things that have been destroyed by them that they've not been allowed to follow. And maybe there were other investigative reports they could have done or would have done if they were allowed to. And it seems to me that it really makes me question the integrity of the guys who work there. It really does. Because I know now two stories firsthand of what happened and how they operate, and they won't let certain things come out.
Yeah.
They just won't.
Well,
so how do you work for that entity? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on that note, I guess we're close. Can I just keep you for like 5-10 more minutes?
Sure.
All right. I'll save the more comprehensive question for after the show because we got like 5 minutes left. Tell me what you're doing right now. What's coming next? What are you working on? Where are you writing now? Because I was reading your stuff at Sports on Earth, and then they cratered.
Blew up.
Yeah.
That was depressing,
day.
Let me tell you. You're not alone saying that was depressing. There was a lot of people who went out of work that day.
Yeah, that was fugly.
Yeah, I kind of hooked up with Vice Sports now,
mm-hmm.
and I'm kind of a contributor for them, but I've only contributed one article thus far because I'm working on a book about all the gambling that goes on around the NFL and the NFL's anti-gambling stance. So I'm working on that right now. And then I'm actually working with Lance Williams at the center again on another investigative piece that we just kind of started. And I don't want to talk about that just yet. But hopefully it leads to something pretty big and exciting down the line.
All right. Nice. Nice. And then tell me about disaster government, because that's right in the wheelhouse of the BOA audio listeners and something I'll have to get you on in the future to talk about. But plug that and let people know about that.
Well, disaster government is kind of like my side project, you know, like how certain lead singers in a band have like a side project. That was like my side project.
Yeah.
I was always interested in continuity of government stories and, you know, stories of underground bases and things of that nature, what the government would do in the event of a nuclear war, what it can do. And that's what led me to disaster government, because that's really what it's all about, is national emergencies, presidential executive orders, and how the government has the ability, or president really has the ability, to overthrow the government just by declaring a national emergency and then putting all these emergency plans into action, which already exist on the books, and really overthrow the constitutional form of government in one fell swoop if they so desired.
It's pretty wild stuff. And
the disaster government was all based, I mean, it's all based on actual government files.
Right.
Stuff I obtained for the Freedom of Information Act and stuff I dug up online and elsewhere. It's funny because I went into it as that kind of conspiracy theorist thinking, okay, some of the stuff I've read in other books and elsewhere has got to be just nonsense. And the more I dug into it and found the actual files these things were based on and put it all together, I realized this is not a conspiracy theory. This is reality. It's just nobody's bothered to actually take advantage of it and enact it. But it's there, it's on the books, and it could be enacted, and it would really be a bad, bad thing.
Yeah, it's that whole, yeah, that's all. like I
it's
said,
a whole other topic. Like
right,
today.
Right,
it's
right.
A whole different ball of wax.
Yeah, that's right in the BOA audio wheelhouse. So we'll have to get my hands on that and bring you back on the show to talk about that. But I've really this is sort of the wrap up here. But like I said, hang out just a few more minutes because I got a couple more questions for you. Let me plug your stuff here: Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI, as well as The Fix Is In, the showbiz manipulations of the NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. And we really even didn't get into that stuff, folks. So we're going to have to do this again in the future because there's so much more to talk about. Performance-enhancing fuels in NASCAR was one thing I had in the notes that we will not be getting into tonight. So pick up The Fix Is In just for that. That's tremendous stuff and really mind-blowing material. And like I said, we're living in this sort of fabricated reality world that we live in, and sports is part of all that, and you really need to take a closer look at it, my friends, and that's why we did this program tonight. And the website is thefixisin.net. That's where you can find out more from Brian Toohey. Tremendous stuff on there, and really a tremendous conversation. I really enjoyed it, Brian.
Well, I did too, Tim. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And if people want to, feel free to send me any email questions, comments, thoughts, whatever. I always respond. So if somebody has something they want to throw my way, feel free to do so.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, definitely go out and pick up these books. They are really awesome, and I really enjoyed them quite a bit. And big thanks to the folks who tuned in on the live program and the folks listening on the MP3s. I know that we do an annual baseball show. We bring in all the different big paranormal names who are baseball fans and just talk about baseball and make our predictions for the baseball season, and that's always a lot of fun. And the predictions are usually terrible, and no one does very well. And it's also the least listened to program of the year, so I hope that's not the case tonight, because like Brian was saying, this is real stuff. We've been talking about real stuff here on the show the last few weeks. We're getting more into the real world. You know, there's a lot of fun with the Bigfoots and the UFOs and stuff like that, but you cannot deny the reality of sports and then what's really going on under the scenes. So thanks to all the live folks for listening. We'll have a little bit more here on the MP3, and we've just lost a lot of listeners. Great. So let me just hit you with two more questions. Is that all right, Brian?
Sure.
Awesome. No, thanks. We're still rolling here on the show, but the live folks are out. I thought it was interesting you have a section on your website, Censorship Against You, situations where your stuff's been not allowed to make it to the greater airwaves, which I thought was really interesting because it's like I want to make this point. I'm glad we still have a little more time here, you know, to talk because I wanted to make this point on the show. For anyone who's like, oh, a sports show, oh, I got ESPN, I got all these things on TV. Why do you want to do sports and all? It's like this is the sports stuff that the sports channels won't tell you about.
Exactly.
So that's why we want to cover it on the program. So I guess talk about your, you know, you being held outside of the gates, if you will, of sports media to talk about this stuff.
Well, I lay it out kind of in that article, but there's been times where I think the biggest one for me was there was this television show called The Daily Line, which used to be on Versus, which is now NBC Sports, the NBC Sports Network, and it was owned by NBC back in the day. But they had the show called The Daily Line, and a producer from that show sent me an email and said, oh, we want to have you on the show tomorrow, literally tomorrow. And I said, okay, that's great, but I'm in, you know, like Wisconsin, you're in New York, and I can't be there tomorrow, okay? Love to be, but I just can't up and go. I go, but if you give me 2 weeks, I go, you know, I could sort out my work schedule whenever, and I can get there. And the guy was like, cool, great, we'll have you. And then all of a sudden another producer got involved, and suddenly everything changed. And suddenly the entire format of the show, I was informed, changed in that 2 weeks, and that meant they couldn't have me on the show. And I ran into issues like that with other things, like a local radio show in Chicago, where I actually went to college and all that, was going to have me on, and then suddenly, once they got a copy of The Fix Is In and really saw, I think, what the content of the book was, decided, oh, we can't have this guy on because we can't have somebody talking about this sort of thing. And I think that's what happened with The Daily Line. It happened in Chicago, and it's happened elsewhere to me, where once people realize what I'm going to talk about and what I'm going to bring up, they won't have me.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I call the censorship by omission, is they're not censoring me, they're not stopping me from saying what I want to say, but at the same time, they're not having me on and giving me a greater audience to broadcast it to. Mm. And I think, you know, again, I'm talking about sports, which to me is relatively meaningless. And so I wonder how many other people out there with bigger stories, more important stories, are running into the same sort of brick wall where they could make a big difference, a big impact in a variety of different things, but nobody gives them the chance to because their message is just deemed to be the wrong kind of message.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too. Like I said, you know, I watch some of these talking head shows on ESPN and stuff, and they, like, never really, you just never bring up any of this stuff. It's amazing.
No, I'd love to be on one for a half hour.
Yeah.
I really would. Because, I mean, I would get them so aggravated, frustrated. I mean, they would want to lynch me by the time it was over. I mean, they really would. But, I mean, they won't, and they just won't dare to do so.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's, you know, they'll have their own commentary. They'll have their own little controversial type of takes. But they won't push things to that next level. They won't really question why something is, especially, like you say, with bad calls.
Hmm.
In, like, football or other leagues, you know, you can't interview referees. Nobody does. Nobody interviews referees. You can ask a player after the game, well, why'd you throw that interception? Why'd you fumble that ball? Why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? But nobody can go to the referee and say, how the hell did you blow that call? I mean, we saw an instant replay. That guy, it was a touchdown, and yet you said it wasn't.
Hmm.
And it cost that team the game. Why not? Nobody can ask those questions. Why? I mean, there's a lot of things that could be asked, a lot of things these guys should be asking, a lot of these things these guys should be questioning, and they just won't do it. And I can't necessarily believe that they're that stupid, but at the same time, I think they know where their bread is buttered.
Right.
So they intentionally are that stupid.
Yeah. It's funny because you see that kind of bubble up a little bit sometimes in the NBA where you see the coaches or the owners, like Mark Cuban or whatever, complain about the officiating and stuff. Then they're hit with huge fines, and it's like,
yeah,
you can tell.
Well, and again,
just,
that's isn't that a form of censorship?
Yeah.
Right? I complain about the officiating, which was bad, which might have been 100% wrong, but yet you'll find me $50,000 for saying that.
Yeah.
Which is, like, you know, more than I've seen from either one of my books. By far. You know, and people say, wow, it's only 50 grand, big deal, that guy made $10 million, that guy makes $1 million. It's still a lot of money.
Yeah.
Still a lot of cash. That's, you know, year or two salary for some people. And that's just because they question the official? Really? Why is that? Nobody questions it.
Yeah. They don't want anybody even asking questions, especially, you know, especially after that Donaghy thing. That was even more suspicious the way that all went down. So.
Oh, totally, especially with ESPN. Again, the biggest contributor to the NBA, the worldwide leader in sports, basically let that story go because it meant too much to him.
Yeah. Now, the only other thing I had here in the notes, well, I had other stuff, but this is, I figured I'll throw this one in because it was kind of, it's more recent. This is the 2014 World Cup and how these African nations were pretty much just selling games, you know, willing to throw games for large sums of money. And it seemed like it was pretty apparent. It was pretty clear. It wasn't really like that shadowy of a thing. It was, they were pretty brazen about it, right?
Well, it's something that's never been actually proven that it did happen, but it looked really, really bad, you know, at the same time. So you can't say for certain it has happened or did happen at this last World Cup, but we know at other World Cups it did certainly happen.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how these, you know, game fixtures in soccer operate, is they find, especially like the third world teams. And one of the things which I didn't even know was that the players aren't necessarily paid to play in the World Cup. What happens is the FIFA, the organization behind the World Cup, actually pays the country's soccer organization, and then that organization is supposed to pay the players for their participation. But what happens in a lot of third world countries is FIFA pays that country's soccer federation, and the money goes no further. So the players show up, and you know, they don't get paid for doing what it is they do. So it's just like, you know, college sports here. Fixers come along and say, hey, you're not going to get paid, or you're only going to get paid, you know, $5,000 when you're owed $25,000. How about I make up that extra $20,000 you're missing, and you don't do so well, because let's face it, you're a third world team, and the chances of you beating England are nil anyway, so how about you make a little money? And
right.
That's just how easy it is. And it's amazing because it still is, you know, there's still that idea in sports, the underdog can achieve. Like, look at the Kansas City Royals in the World Series. The underdog can do it. But at the same time, money talks a lot louder than that whole Rocky mentality of the underdog can do it, and you can fix a game in literally the world's most watched sporting event, and you can do it regularly, and it's happened. It's been proven it's happened.
Hmm. It's just amazing the blinders that people have on that they don't even consider this. you know, that they don't even consider the chicanery that may be involved in all in professional sports as far as fixing and stuff like that goes. It's just crazy.
Well, and it's funny, too, because I run into that with some of these radio interviews I've done. And going back to the whole censorship thing, is sometimes I've been on these shows, and I think, you know, sometimes the producers have me on and the hosts don't quite know why I'm on
or what I'm going to
talk about. You know, it's just kind of all like they don't bother to read the book or anything. They're just like, all right, here comes this guy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I was on like one NBC sports radio show where the guy was like, oh, so you believe in Bigfoot, you believe in UFOs? And I'm like, dude, that's not even close to like what I'm talking about, okay? We're on the totally different levels here. But at the same time, I bring up some of the stuff like I brought up with you, and the guys are like flabbergasted. So they're like, really? I mean, not like they're being idiots. I mean, they really just don't know. And I bring up some of these facts and figures, and they're just blown away. And they've been so insulated into their little worlds that they don't even recognize what's going on in these sports. And that's the part that just blows my mind, because it's like, look, I do this. I got a real job. You know, I kind of do this as a hobby. This is like a part-time thing for me. And I know all this. How can you be that naive and be doing this full-time and fully immersed in sports? I mean, I just don't know how you function.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's like the house of cards. They don't even want to look at it because it might all come tumbling down. And that's how they make their money anyway. So it's all, it's
yeah, well, again, they get paid for being naive, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. all right, let me just throw the plugs in one more time, and then I'll let you get going. Larceny Games, sports gambling, game fixing, and the FBI, as well as The Fix is In, the showbiz manipulations of the NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. Also, Disaster Government. Those are the three books by Brian Toohey. Brian, I really enjoyed this conversation quite a bit. I was looking forward to it ahead of time and just loved it because there was so much stuff I wanted to ask you about and got a chance to really pick your brain on all these different conspiracy theories. And we, like I said, when we were saying goodbye to the live audience, there's tons more stuff we didn't even get into. So, folks, go out and pick up these books. You really will get an eye-opening experience learning more about what's going on behind the scenes. It's really, really, really remarkable stuff. So I got to commend you, too, dude. I mean, this is not an easy topic to look into. You're really running up against a lot of brick walls, I'm sure, and I'm sure that it's frustrating at times to look into it, and especially being one of the only people doing it. You know, it's not like you're a paranormal researcher where there's tons of people doing this stuff. You're really kind of standing alone, being the voice in the wilderness on the nefarious nature of sports. So kudos to you, man. Hopefully, we can bring you back on the show, talk more about this stuff.
Well, thanks. I appreciate all the praise. And it is fun because, in a way, because, you know, a lot of people tell me I really just flat out ruin sports for them. I know all this stuff. It just ruins it for them. And so I can take, you know, a little, I guess, pride in that. But, no, I really appreciate it because it is, I thank you for having me on the show. And it is nice because it's fans and stuff like that that kind of keep me doing what it is I do because, like I say, it's kind of a hobby for me. I don't make a lot of money from this. And as you've seen, I get shunned by basically the sports media world. So it's really all about just kind of doing this for fans and other people who have the same feelings that I do about sports, that it's not really what it seems, and you need to get beyond the surface and see what's really going on underneath.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thanks again. I'm going to let you get going now because all I do now is plug upcoming shows. So thanks again, my friend, and hopefully we'll talk again in the future.
Well, thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a nice night.
You too.
For those folks who are listening on Blog Talk Radio and are unfamiliar with this program, it is Banal of America. We cover all sorts of stuff. As you've learned from the last 2 hours, we cover the paranormal, and we also cover the fringe pop culture conspiracy type stuff as well. And you can find out more about us at banalofamerica.com. Pretty simple, B-I-N-N-A-L-L ofamerica.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Just punch in Banal of America on Facebook. Pretty easy. That'll bring up our Facebook page. That's where we try to give out the latest news on BOA Audio and what's coming up in the future. What you just heard was a two-hour conversation live with Brian Toohey, author of The Fix is In. It was totally free, my friends, and it has been free since the very beginning. 8 seasons, 230-plus episodes. All for free for the BOA Audio listeners via donations from the BOA fans. How is that possible? simple. Head on over to Banal of America and make a donation via PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to mail us a snail mail donation, we also have a P.O. box. So just head on over to Banal of America for that address. Now, I know since we're doing a sports episode, even though it's sports conspiracy, we're probably reaching the hardcore BOA audio listeners. So I'll reward you for your tenacity by announcing the information here on the BOA Audio Season 8 finale. Because as I said at the very beginning of this program, this was episode 33. Traditionally, we end at 33, but this year we're going to end at 35 because we have two huge interviews coming up next week that will serve as the finale for BOA Audio Season 8. And we're going to break from tradition in a lot of ways this year as we close the book on this season. Because first of all, next week on Tuesday afternoon Eastern Time, we're going to be bringing back a guest who is already on the show in Season 8 to help us wrap up this season because he has got something that is going to be world-shaking, I believe. Our guest will be longtime friend of BOA Audio, Adam Davies, who is coming back to the program to, for the first time ever and exclusively on BOA Audio, reveal the details of the secret Bigfoot expedition that was funded and organized by Oxford University's Dr. Brian Sykes. A couple years ago, Dr. Brian Sykes reached out to Adam Davies and Laurie Simmons and organized a clandestine trip to America to look for Bigfoot. And the results of this expedition were apparently mind-blowing. And personally, I think this is going to end up being one of the biggest Bigfoot stories of the year, if not within the realm of the biggest stories. This is a huge, huge story. We're talking about an Oxford University professor organizing a Bigfoot expedition and some crazy, crazy stuff happening on that expedition. Adam's got a new book coming out called Man Beasts, where he lays out this story. But for the first time ever, and as I said, exclusively on BOA Audio. This is a worldwide exclusive. Adam promised me this story a few months ago, told me it was percolating, told me to get ready for it, and now he can finally tell the story of the Dr. Sykes expedition. Folks, from what I've heard in private from Adam, this is some tremendous stuff, and I'm going to be getting my hands on the new book, Man Beasts, later this week so I can really dig into the story in depth. And then next week on the show, Tuesday afternoon, Adam Davies is going to reveal the whole thing. He's going to tell us all about it. Trust me, folks, this is going to be an absolute barn burner edition of the program. And as I said, I think it's going to be really newsworthy in a huge, huge way. But that's not all. That's just part one of Finale Week because that's going to be on Tuesday. Thursday, by huge demand, by popular demand, isn't even words enough for this guest. Someone who people have been requesting to be on BOA Audio for years will finally appear on the show, David Paulides, author of the Missing 411 books. He's going to be joining us for an hour on Thursday evening to talk about the Missing 411 research that has really shook the esoteric and paranormal community over the last few years. Long overdue, long awaited. Finally, David Paulides is coming to BOA Audio. That's next Thursday. So in total, Adam Davies with the worldwide exclusive interview telling us all about the clandestine Dr. Sykes Bigfoot expedition. That's going to be on Tuesday. Thursday, David Paulides talking about Missing 411 as we close the book on BOA Audio Season 8. A huge week next week, my friends. BOA Audio Season 8 Finale Week. Adam Davies, David Paulides. Stay tuned to Banal of America and BOA on Facebook for more information on when these episodes will be coming at you. Both of them will be broadcast live, and then they'll be available via MP3. Full scheduling information available at Banal of America and BOA on Facebook. And with all that said, we close the book here on this edition of the program. I'm nearly out of breath. certainly almost out of voice. Thank you so much to the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the folks who are the fuel that drives the BOA mothership. Thank you for your enduring support of this program. And, of course, thank you for making BOA audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.